It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It seems everybody these days wants to be a chef. The success of food TV has turned this profession into the dream job of kids everywhere. But being on TV is not being a chef. You need to run a restaurant to be able to call yourself one. And what's that life like? Well, today we talk to Chef April Bloomfield. She runs a well-respected group of restaurants in New York City. However, she's a chef who prefers the cooking part of her job over the celebrity part of it.
It's basically like an orchestra. You know, the head chef is basically like a conductor. And it's the most wonderful feeling, you know, when you have an amazing expediter and you have an amazing head chef. You know, it really is just a buzz. You know, it's like a dance.
Stay with us for the real life of a chef and lots more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This podcast is supported by Citrus Lane, the service that helps parents discover the best products for their children. Each month, you'll receive products based on your child's development stage. For 50% off first month, visit citruslane.com/splendid.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Restaurant sycophants love to throw around words like stage and mise, chef de partie, commis, sous. But what do they mean? As celebrity chef Wolfgang Puck once said, it seems that everyone wants to be on TV and everyone wants to own their own restaurant, and that's before they ever even learn how to cook. So what does it take to learn to be a real cook, not just play one on TV? April Bloomfield is one of the hottest chefs around with her New York restaurants that include the Spotted Pig and the Breslin. Her celebrity, however, unfolds entirely behind the swinging door rather than in front of a camera. She loves to cook, and she's the author of A Girl and Her Pig. The New York Times' Melissa Clark caught up with April to talk about real life in the restaurant kitchen.
Hi, April.
Hi, Melissa.
There are so many ways that people can become a chef these days, and I know that you've had very classical training. What does that mean?
Classical training means basically that you have had some time in a professional kitchen. And depending on what style of kitchen they are, they range in different hierarchies within that kitchen.
And did you go to cooking school?
I did go to cooking school in Birmingham, which was Birmingham College of Food. Mm-hmm. And I did 2 years there, my basic training, from 16 to 18. And after I left that cooking school, I went then on to a professional kitchen. And I did that while I'm still in a professional kitchen. So I'm still there. So 24 years later, you know.
But now you're in charge.
Yeah, exactly.
But you did go to cooking school. But you, when you talked about what a classical education is, you didn't mention it. So do you need to go to cooking school to be a chef?
In this day and age, no. I think you just need a restaurant group or a restaurant that's willing to teach and mm-hmm. help you grow as a professional cook. I don't think you need to do that and pay all that money.
Yep.
But obviously, you need to pick the right restaurant to do that.
Yeah, so someone can just come and knock on your kitchen door and
yes,
say,
exactly.
Hey, I want to work for you, and mm-hmm. that's okay. And what's the first thing they do?
Well, I have a classic example. Many years ago, I think I had opened the Pig about a year into that. Somebody knocked on my door, a nice guy named Peter Cho. And he came in very nervously and asked if he could have a job. I said, well, okay, why don't you just make me something and then, you know, we'll take it from there. So he went home and next day he brought in, you know, these ingredients, and it was striped bass, some fennel and some salad. And so he went and made that, and it was the most delicious thing. And I'm like, okay, you can have a job.
but you
have to start from the bottom and then work your way
and
up.
And so when you start from the bottom, what is that called?
It's basically an apprentice.
Or a stage.
Or a stage. But more like an apprentice. A stage is somebody where you can just go for a certain amount of time. It's just maybe a 1 week, 2 week, maybe a month, just to kind of feel out whether you like that job or they like you.
And you don't get paid for that.
Usually you don't get paid for that, yeah.
And then what would be the next step after that?
The next step would probably be a commis, uh-huh. Which is like a line cook, basically. And you'd probably most likely to start on colds, which is the lower end of the kitchen. It's the most simple. Well, actually, sometimes it can be the most complicated, too, like our cold station on at the Pig is quite involved and quite, you know, intense because we have a lot of salads. But yeah, depending on the restaurant, it's usually that's where you start.
And when you knock on that door, what should you have with you so you can look the part? So you're knocking on the door, you've never worked in a kitchen, you need to come with a knife kit?
You know, if we were to advise people that would like to just go knock on somebody's restaurant door, then yes, you should come with a knife kit, some reasonable kitchen shoes, usually clogs that are oil and fat resistant.
Okay.
So you don't slip. And you know, then it may be a bit more sturdy. So if you drop a pan on your foot, you're not going to hurt your toes.
Maybe something with a steel toe.
Steel toe cap shoe is very important. You know, some good kind of sturdy pants that are oil proof, and you know, a hat, and hopefully they'll supply you with an apron and a jacket.
And what do you need in that chef kit?
You'll need a paring knife, a chef knife, maybe a 10-inch chef knife. And that's really, like, maybe a peeler, and that's basically all you need, you know. And then when you get more experienced, you can get into the filleting knives, the boning knives. But right now, you're just doing the basics, so I think that's good.
And chances are you're also going to be doing a lot of prep cook work, right? You might become
yes.
a prep cook.
So a prep cook is basically somebody that does all the peeling, all the picking, the chopping, and then usually hands it over to a line cook.
Right.
Or you can just forget about the prep cook in some restaurants. You have a line cook, and they do their own prep.
So it depends on how big the restaurant is.
Exactly.
You probably in the Spotted Pig, in a small kitchen like that, it's fewer people.
Exactly.
But then in the Breslin, you'd have more.
Yeah. You know, we find a balance between having prep cooks that prep the larger bulk of the product, and then the chefs do the refined, more delicate things.
And so tell me the difference between a sous chef, a chef de partie, and then you mentioned a commis.
Okay, so the upper echelon of the kitchen, it usually starts with an executive chef that oversees.
That's you.
That's me. That oversees the head chef. The head chef then is over a sous chef. And then below the sous chef is sometimes, if it's a big kitchen, junior sous, chef de partie, and then a commis. So it kind of goes down like that.
And what do each one of them do? So you were talking about how the commis works on the line?
Yes, the commis is usually the one under a chef de partie, and the chef de partie is in control and kind of oversees that station.
So the chef de partie is watching the commis cook and the commis cook the fish.
The commis doesn't probably normally get to cook the fish. The chef de partie will do that, but maybe the commis will season the fish, get the fish out of the fridge. So it's a very minimal job, depending on how much, you know, responsibility you have. And they vary.
And then that same plate of fish goes over to the sous chef.
Goes over to the sous chef. The sous chef will wipe the plate, maybe garnish with something. And then the head chef will be behind the sous chef, usually making sure that everything's running smoothly and maybe expediting. Or there might be another expediter, and the head chef will just be, you know, overseeing the whole. It's basically like an orchestra. You know, the head chef is basically like a conductor, and they're kind of, you know, making sure everything's coming together.
And that's what expediting is?
And an expediter does the same thing. They're basically a conductor, and they tell people what to do.
So they say, you, fish now, because it needs to come out at the same time as you over there, chicken.
Yes, exactly. And it's the most wonderful feeling, you know, when you have an amazing expediter and you have an amazing head chef. You know, it really is just a buzz. You know, it's like a dance.
And then the executive chef?
The executive chef usually oversees the head chef. You know, obviously, eventually the head chef's going to want to become an executive chef. So the executive chef normally helps the head chef learn about food costs, payroll, all those intricate things about running a business.
And doing interviews like this one.
And doing an interview like this one, exactly.
April, these days I feel like everyone calls themselves a chef. Even home cooks call themselves chefs. What is a true chef?
A chef, that's a good question. You know, sometimes even I refer to myself as a cook. I mean, I don't know. I think a chef probably knows just the business side as well as the creative side. And I think they probably should have to have done that for a certain amount of time. I suppose it depends too. Like, I'm quite a humble person. So sometimes when people ask what I do, I'm like, oh, I cook, you know, because I do. That's what I do, you know.
So the chef really refers to the whole entire profession
yes.
of being the head of a restaurant
right,
kitchen.
Right, exactly.
And for you, the best part of that is cooking.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
April, loved talking to you today. Thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure.
April Bloomfield is the author of A Girl and Her Pig. Melissa Clark's latest book is Cook This Now. April left us with a recipe for carrot, avocado, and orange salad. You know where you're going to find it. SplendidTable.org. simple table salt can be transformative on food. I mean, imagine unsalted potato chips or French fries. But what's happening to the potato chips and the French fries when salt hits them? Why does salty caramel taste so good? Why should we add salt to coffee? What's salt doing to that melon that makes it taste so great? Well, understanding how salt affects the taste of food is what every cook needs to know to bring their A-game to the kitchen. Dr. Paul Breslin is a professor of experimental psychology who researches taste perception at Rutgers University and at Monell Chemical Senses Center. He is called the Don of Taste Perception, and he joins us today to explain why salt changes food so much. Paul, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So what does happen when salt hits our tongues?
So salt in a crystalline form has to first dissolve into saliva in order for us to taste it. Everything we taste generally comes in some sort of aqueous form. So for solids, they go into saliva, and then from there, they actually go into tiny holes in the epithelia of the mouth and touch the very tips of taste receptor cells there where there are proteins that they can interact with. They either bind to a protein to activate a cell, or they will go into the cell and then activate the cell. In the case of salts, we believe they go through a pore or a window in the cell that's made by a protein, and from there they turn the cell on, and we're in the process right now trying to understand what those channels or those windows or pores are, but we're pretty sure that the sodium is actually going straight from the salt shaker or whatever food you're eating into the cells themselves of the taste system.
And the taste system, do you mean what we call taste buds that are on our tongue, or are there other receptors as well?
So the taste buds are an actual sort of micro organ. They're made up of a cluster of about 80 to 100 cells. They're put together in an assemblage that kind of looks like a rosebud, which is in fact why they're called taste buds.
Uh-huh.
And they're microscopic. You can't see them by looking at your tongue in a mirror or looking at someone else's tongue. And on those cells are the receptors. So when we're talking about taste buds, we're talking about a very tiny organ. And when we talk about receptors, we're talking about the proteins on those cells. What you see when you stick your tongue out at yourself in the mirror, those bumps are called papillae. And inside one of those bumps, you can have anywhere between 0 and maybe 20 or so taste buds.
Oh, my. Let's go back to the examples I use. For instance, salty caramel. This is a big deal now, you know, and ice cream and everything you can imagine. What's happening there?
There's a couple different phenomena going on. One is that you're mixing together two qualities of taste that we love. So we're very attracted to sweet taste, which comes from the sugar. And we very much like salt taste in its own right. So we like the salt and we like the sweet. Mixing them together is even better. Caramel also goes through a process when it's heated that it makes compounds that are byproducts of the cooking of the sugar that will make chemicals that have an off taste to them. So if you really burn sugar, you're in effect making it extremely bitter. If you go to the process of just beginning to brown it, it can take on some of the notes or odors that we really like that are part of the caramelization process, but it will become a little bit bitter at the same time. And salt can interact with some of those bitter notes to make them weaker. So it also is modifying the flavor process.
And is that why a little salt when you're making coffee? Because does it take down the bitter side of coffee as well?
It's very common for people to add salt to, I guess, what you might call not great coffee. I don't know that people would add salt to a really good cup of coffee, but for sort of generic coffee, a little bit of salt will take down the bitter notes and make it a little more pleasant. And if the bitterness is low level, a little pinch of salt will probably benefit almost any dish.
Do you have any tips for cooks? For instance, salting well ahead when you're cooking something like meat versus salting after cooking?
I think salt is probably necessary at both ends of cooking for very different reasons. And I think to adhere to the general advice of the whole biomedical complex, which is that we should decrease the amount of salt that we're eating. If you put all the salt in the cooking up front, you're going to create what I think is generally recognized as hidden salt, that the salt is going to bind to really large molecules like proteins in the food, and it'll be there and you'll be eating it, but it won't really be affecting the taste of the food, so it'll be a waste. You really want the salt to be useful for the taste and flavor of the food. Hidden salt does no one any good here. And there's a general phenomenon, which is the larger the molecule a sodium ion is associated with, the less you're going to taste it. So I can give you a whole series of sodium salts at the exact same concentration and have them go all the way from very salty to barely perceptibly salty at all, simply by how big the thing it's attached to is. So when you attach it to large proteins in food, you just don't taste that salt. But rather than take all of the salt out and put it at the end, you need some there up in the beginning because it engages in the cooking process. It is necessary for browning effects, caramelization, generation of Maillard reactants, and for interaction with things like yeast in a baked good. Mm-hmm. It's necessary for the yeast to do its thing. So it will affect texture, bubble size, crust production, all of that. So you have to have some up front. But I would also say put in the minimum that you need to allow those cooking processes to occur. And then at the end, salt to taste. You'll be able to put in much less salt than you would have had you put it all in at the beginning. The food will taste presumably great, and you'll be eating less salt that way.
This is a great thing to remember when you're cooking. Thank you very much, Paul.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Paul Breslin is a professor in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at Rutgers University. Now, you can put your new salt wisdom to use with a recipe for whole fish roasted in salt. And you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, biodynamic wine in South Africa with the duo from the Perennial Plate and the marriage of food and music. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
This podcast is supported by Citrus Lane. Finding the right products for each stage of your child's development can be time-consuming. With Citrus Lane, you'll save time and money. Each month, you'll receive books, toys, and items based on your child's development stage. The products advance as your child grows, so the delight and discovery never stops as your child reaches new milestones. Boxes start at $19, including shipping. For 50% off first month, visit citruslane.com/splendid.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The Perennial Plate duo, chef Daniel Klein and camerawoman Mira Fine, traveled the planet, finding their way into home kitchens, onto farms and fishing boats, into fields and plantations, and reporting on what is happening in the global food scene. They covered 12 countries in 18 months, and they join us here to report. Mira, Daniel, good to have you back.
So good to be back.
Great to be back.
Where have you been?
So we just came back from South Africa, and we spent 2 weeks there traveling from the north to the south, filming stories.
It's just a gorgeous country with every sort of landscape. It's incredible. Going to South Africa, we really wanted to represent the diversity of South Africa. It's a country that is full of stark contrasts. Wealthy people, poor people. It's very divided and difficult to navigate country. And so we wanted to share a bunch of different perspectives, from the poor townships to wine country to village life. We wanted to show a lot of the different perspectives. So we ended up filming 4 or 5 stories, which is more than we usually do.
Uh-huh.
One story that stands out is we were in wine country in Stellenbosch, which is about an hour outside of Cape Town, and we filmed this biodynamic farmer and winemaker, Johan Reinecke, who also was a former pro surfer, or semi-pro surfer, actually. So we started out the filming surfing with him.
Oh, my.
Yeah, we were like, oh, we get to go surfing? That sounds great. So we started off early in the morning and drove up the west coast of South Africa. Just beautiful coastline, kind of like Big Sur.
Oh.
And you're looking over the edge of the cliff and you see whales and dolphins and all this wildlife down below. And we hired, for the first time, an extra cameraman who was a underwater cameraman, like a professional surfing cameraman. But so they have shark spotters, because there's a lot of sharks in South Africa. So they up on the cliff, they have a guy who sits there all day and just watches for sharks. And while they were in the water, and while I was just going into the water, they spotted a 3-meter-long shark. And so we all had to, like,
run out of the water. That's 9 feet.
Yeah, that's a 9-foot shark.
2 meters away from our guy.
Oh.
Yes.
Yes. So our winemaker almost got eaten by a shark.
This is not a good thing. So what made him so interesting to you?
I mean, obviously there was this surfing bent, but I think the biodynamic thing is really interesting for us, and he had a good way of explaining it.
Yeah, I haven't understood it for a very long time, and I've met with other biodynamic farmers before. How he explained it to us was, he said, if I had a piece of paper that I wanted to get rid of, I could either throw it away in the garbage can, and that would be waste, or if I was a sustainable farmer, I could recycle it. But if I'm a biodynamic farmer, I put it through a shredder, feed that to my earthworm farm, and then take those earthworms and put those back into the soil. So it's like a holistic way to view your farm as like one being. You know, nothing dies and just goes away. It dies to bring life to something else on the farm. So if you look at, you know, the weeds are not just weeds. They're there for a reason, to keep away a type of bug or to help something else grow or to shade something else on the farm.
So what kind of wines does he make?
He makes he has a number of different grapes, so he's not committed to one varietal. There is the famous wine in South Africa, which is Pinotage, so he grows that, but he also does a Sauvignon Blanc. But he's someone who takes these grapes, does not put any extra things to help ferment it. He used the natural yeast on the grapes, no chemicals, no nothing. So it's just grapes and thyme. He's doing his wine in a completely natural way, and he also he's really proud of his staff and kind of takes them in a similar way. And he introduced us to each member of the staff and shared what their value to his farm was with us.
Uh-huh.
So he's taking the best of what each thing has to offer.
Including the people.
And he really strayed away from, you know, there is the moon cycle related to biodynamic farming. And there's the thing like putting quartz in the horn of a cow. And he was like, that's part of biodynamic farming. But really what it's about is this interplay with the ecosystem.
The other interesting thing about him was that he started out as a farm worker, which is very unusual in that area. He's Afrikaner, which means his family is originally Dutch years back. And so when he was on the farm, he said he was the only white person that was a farm worker. And eventually he was able to raise money and start his own farm and wanted to bring some of his fellow farm workers to own the farm with them, but they were worried about the risk that would go into it, so he ended up doing it himself.
But he did bring on those people, the farm workers that he had joined with to start this farm, whose knowledge he wanted to have as part of his farm, that they would work towards at least everyone having a house. And we were in South Africa when Nelson Mandela died.
Oh.
And we were with this farmer the day before he died. And it felt really like maybe the people of South Africa were all like sharing their stories of Nelson Mandela.
Uh-huh.
So he told us about the time that he was able to meet this hero. And he was apparently introduced and struck for words. And so Nelson Mandela said, "What do you do?" And he said, "Well, I'm a farmer." And then the incredible thing that Nelson Mandela did, which was he switched into the language of the oppressor, which is Afrikaans, which is, you know, what the enemy of the black people at that time were, the strongest ones were the Afrikaans. And he switched into this man's language and said, "How are our farmers?" And Johan was just unable to speak because here was this man who could have had this hatred towards him. Instead, he asked him about him in his own language. And so we were sitting around his kitchen table tasting these wines, and he told us this story.
We were all crying.
The day before Nelson Mandela died, and we were just like, it was really moving. And the reason he got to meet Nelson Mandela, because he had chosen to include his farm workers and buy them houses as part of their business plan of like having ownership, they were basically in debt and about to go out of business and lose everything.
Really?
And this woman who was organizing an award ceremony for African journalists was looking to buy wine for this huge event. And she happened to show up, going around Stellenbosch, tasting wines, showed up at his farm, and she asked him, you look kind of down. And he explained how he was trying to help his community and provide good living wages as well as homes for these people, but they weren't able to sell their wine. And she proceeded to buy all of their wine for this huge event. And then he goes to the event and meets Nelson Mandela.
This is fairy tale material in many ways. What is the name of his vineyard?
It's his last name.
Yeah, it's Reinecke.
Reinecke. Does he export?
He does, to the East Coast, I think.
It makes sense to support someone like this.
Yeah, it really does.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Klein and Mira Fine are the creators of theperennialplate.com. Now, for more information on their stories and to see their gorgeous videos, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Frederick Douglass Opie is a food historian who is fascinated with stories about food and traditions and how food shapes history. He's professor of history and foodways at Babson College and writes the blog Food as a Lens. Our producer Jennifer Russell sat down with Fred to talk about a connection many of us may not consider, that between Southern food and music.
Fred, welcome.
Oh, great to be here.
I'd love for you to talk a bit about Southern food's connection to the jazz and blues culture.
Well, the connection is an old one, and I first came across it as I was working on a book on the anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston. She did a lot of her field work during the era of the Great Depression in the Deep South among turpentine camp workers, sawmill camp workers, and also tropical citrus fruit planters and farmers, you know, people working on plantations. And one of the things that you find when you read her work is she talks about the importance of juke joints, that a lot of these workers on their payday, which was typically on a Saturday, is that they would spend time in the juke joints. And these were just kind of shacks where you saw blues music as well as, what we call traditional soul food. You know, and most of these things were kind of eaten, you know, low on the hogs, pig's feet, chitlins, also chicken and some fish. But you would see these two things married together as a way of attracting customers into juke joints. And some of the most noted blues artists on the chitlin circuit, which was these small mom-and-pop venues that before the end of Jim Crow segregation, these were the places where these guys would perform. But if they couldn't get gigs on that, they could always find a juke joint back in the woods someplace where they could make some money and definitely get a full belly. And when we talk about the chitlin circuit, sometimes they were very small, hole-in-the-wall places, but Chitlin Circuit also included places like the Apollo Theater in Harlem. So some of these venues were very small, but in urban areas, they could be very large. And it's true that you see that the term soul is so much related to the Chitlin Circuit and people who made the best they could out of the opportunities they had, whether it be spaces to play their music, places to eat food, or places to perform when nobody else would have them. So it's this whole ideal of surviving with dignity in the midst of very precarious situations.
I really love the spirit of that. Fred, who are the artists that you associate strongly with a food and music connection, the ones who really got their starts in these juke joints that we're talking about?
I think the matriarch among the blues artists would have to be Betsy Smith. She was just a tough woman who not only could belt out the blues, but she could belt you out if you got out of line with her. So she's one of the people that I would definitely go to first.
Let's listen to Bessie.
Sure.
Give me a Bigfoot and a bottle of beer. Send me Kate. I don't care. I feel just like I want a clown. Give the beer and a play a drink because he's bringing me down, he's got a rhythm, yeah.
When I love her.
You know, when I was listening to that song, I just got this chill going down my back, because you know, I could just see this woman in a juke joint or on the stage of the Apollo, just letting it rip. She was a big woman. She could belt it out. But also, when these people first learned how to perform, they did it in juke joints where there was no sound system. And you had people making all kind of ruckus. So, you know, the idea of being able to just let it go and get your song out above the crowd was just one of those things that comes to my mind as I listen to that song. And then after that, I like Fats Waller. I mean, so Betsy Smith, she hails from Tennessee. Fats Waller grew up in Harlem, and most of his career was right there in Harlem. And, you know, people sometimes talk about, rap music today and the music being, you know, talking about all kinds of crazy things that are X-rated. Fats Waller was doing that long before people were talking about rap music. And a lot of his lyrics are around food. I like one of his songs, All That Meat and No Potatoes.
Let's hear that.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes. Yeah, I'm waiting, palpitating, with all that meat and no potatoes. All that meat and no potatoes, all that food to the alligators, yeah. Hold me steady, I am ready with all that meat. potatoes. I don't think
you can just imagine and read between the line of what he's talking about. So this is his escapade with a woman. It's a 1941 song. Fats Waller was a guy who was known for just being an absolute comic genius, great piano player, and a guy who loved food. Fats was at one time something like 300 pounds. And he was known that when he played, he'd have a jug of whiskey that would sit right by him, but like a gallon, like one of those plastic gallon-sized milk containers, but full of whiskey. And he'd be playing all night, and then after he'd play all night, there's a story when he was in Chicago that the gangsters grabbed him, and he went out to Al Capone's place, and when he showed up, they just had nothing but fried chicken and biscuits ready for him and his signature gallon of whiskey.
What a story. Tell me a little bit more about the food connection in these venues.
You know, one of the things that I found out in the state of New York, you couldn't get a liquor license unless you had a way to sell food. You had to have some kind of food and a menu. And I don't know if that was the case in most states, but I suspect it was. So, you know, food and music were always linked together because of that, and also the type of food that's typically sold. It's typically salty type of dishes. So you're talking about pig's feet or trotters, as people call them, chitlin. A lot of these things are very salty, collard greens. And when you're consuming that, the one thing you want to do is you want to then purchase liquor. So it's a way for the club owner to make money. And then what's the music do? The music keeps people in the club so that they're buying more liquor and they're buying more food and then generating more income for that owner.
So, Fred, can you give me a couple examples? And are there any places that still exist?
The two that come to my mind are the Red Rooster in Harlem and Tilly's in Harlem. Red Rooster was one of these places that opened up right around an area that's called Jazz Alley in Harlem. And this is one of those places that would attract both African-Americans, but upperly mobile whites that would come uptown 1920s, 30s, and 40s. So that was a place that you went to hear the music at a club, and then afterwards, sometimes 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, you got hungry, and then you would go to the Red Rooster. Now, gentrification has hit Harlem since Bill Clinton opened his office there. So now Marcus Samuelson, the noted chef, has actually done a facelift and bought the property rights to the Red Rooster, and that's the name of his new restaurant, a great place if you're ever up in Harlem. Then there's Tilly's Chicken Shack. Tilly is a woman who, like many who ended up in Harlem, Harlem is what I would call a Caribbean and Southern diaspora, where people from the South, like her, she grew up in Tampa and at age 16, left on her own, went to Philadelphia first, and then ended up in Harlem. And she started selling chicken really as a kind of a cart. You know, she had a cart set up in front of a speakeasy during the Prohibition. And she saved up enough from the sale of biscuits and chicken to then buy a brick-and-mortar space that became known as Tilly's Chicken Shack. And you see in a lot of artwork, it's no longer in existence, but it certainly had its heyday and was well-known among both the performers of jazz and jazz aficionados.
Fred, what a fascinating connection. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Fred Opie is the author of Hog and Hominy, Soul Food from Africa to America. Jennifer Russell is our producer. Now, you can find Fred's playlist on the website, as well as Southern Chef Bill Smith's recipe for collards. And you know where it is, splendidtable.org. We're going to be back in a minute to talk with you, and we take a fresh look at cooking oils with Ellie Krieger. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You never call my name. It is time to connect with you. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. And, of course, you can always get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. Well, let's see. Who is up? We've got Allison on the phone from Brooklyn, New York. Allison, what's up?
What Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am great. You are living in one of my favorite places because I lived there for quite a while.
Oh, you did? Yeah. I'm loving it. There's so much food everywhere. I'm going crazy.
I know. Brooklyn has gone nuts from what I understand.
I know. It's really true.
So did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to talk to you about a barbecue that I'm going to have.
Yeah.
And I work in this small print shop in Brooklyn, and for this woman who is originally from Santa Fe, but she's spent a lot of time in Paris, and she's a great cook. And we have this artist visiting us from Mallorca in Spain. And we just all work together so well that we wanted to put a special menu together that fuses Santa Fe cuisine and Spain, and, you know, a little French, a little Brooklyn, right. Whatever.
yes. Okay.
Yeah, we just want to have fun with it.
And so what you want is an idea for a menu.
Yeah.
Okay. This is easy. Write a little bit of Mallorca, a little bit, yeah, a little bit of Spain, a little bit of France, a little bit of the Southwest, and a touch of Brooklyn. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, is Junior's Cheesecake still dynamite?
I've never been there, but I was just hearing about it the other day.
Okay, Junior's is a great old shop and coffee shop and whatever in Brooklyn, for those of you who have never known about this. And their cheesecake used to be utterly famous, and that would make a great dessert.
Yeah.
And, okay, here's what I would do. When it comes to Santa Fe, you're talking about New Mex-Mex. And New Mexican food is not Tex-Mex. It's really simple. But one of the things, even though it's not really a summer dish, it's so good. You could start out or have just a big pot of pozole. And pozole, now this is made in Mexico as well, but it's really, I identify it with Santa Fe. And with New Mexico, this is where you take green chilies, roasted green chilies, okay, and you take chunks of pork shoulder, and essentially you're going to make a broth with onion and garlic and oregano, and you're going to slow simmer that pork. And you can find recipes on the web for this.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about pozole that's so wonderful is that you can make it ahead. It's better the next day. And what you're cooking in that broth is the dry, it's actually called pozole. It's a dried corn. It's been treated with lime, and you would almost call it hominy. And you cook that in that mixture of the green chilies and the chunks of pork with a bit of oregano and garlic and chopped onion. And then you can finish that off with either fresh lime. Some people finish it off with sliced avocado and sour cream. But the classic way is this, the pozole, those fabulous green chilies, which make it hot and, I can't explain it, herbal and delicious, and chopped coriander on the top and that dried corn. And as far as the pozole goes, I think you'll find some sources in the city.
Yeah.
You know, in Brooklyn, you'll find it. So, and that cooks for a long time, make it ahead. Now, I think to go to Spain and tie in, I think it would be wonderful to do something like maybe a classic tortilla of pan-fried potatoes turned into an omelet with eggs. You could do a paella. I mean, if you're going to make a feast, you might as well make a feast.
Yeah.
And do a fabulous paella. And then you have two main dishes. And if the paella were all seafood, for those people who don't want to eat meat but do eat fish, they're fine and dandy. You can also there's a vegetable version of paella as well.
Oh.
Yeah, so that's one way to go. Another thing to do is to do something like a gazpacho, but a white gazpacho with grapes and almonds, because that would just be beautiful, and you serve it cool. I'm drawing a blank. There's lots of little tapas. That's another way to go.
Yeah.
You could do olives that you've roasted with fresh herbs. Mm-hmm. And orange peel and chili, and that's one little plate. And then you can have another plate of marinated little onions in sherry vinegar with a tad of sugar, just a tad of sugar, and good olive oil. I'm talking about really easy things, but a lot of snack kinds of things.
Yeah.
So you could do the tapas thing, then the pozole. And then from France, I think you've got to do some sort of fabulous summer salad.
Yeah.
You know, something with little lardons of pork or you could do little fried bits of crouton, you know, really good bread. And then you pan fry it with olive oil and herbs and garlic, and that goes into a salad of all kinds of mixed greens. And you dress that with a really fine olive oil. The other thing is, of course, dessert could be French. And that would be a fabulous fruit tart. But I mean a fruit tart, you know, that's 16 inches wide and looks utterly wonderful. It's done with a beautiful pastry cream or a classic lemon curd that you fold whipped cream into. And then you put the fruit on top of it. Mm-hmm. Are you totally confused? I've been throwing out more ideas than you can shake a stick at.
There's so many great ideas. I have a long list now.
Okay. And
like gazpacho sounds really great.
The gazpacho could be fabulous because everybody expects the tomato version, and the grape and almond version is just wonderful. And the pozole is pure Santa Fe. It really is. So there's some thoughts for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Lynn. I love your show.
Oh, thank you. And you sounds like you work in a really cool place.
Yeah, I really do. I'm lucky, girl.
Hey, say hello to Brooklyn for me.
Okay, I will.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
That's what I call a menu for everybody, which is another way of saying you do a little of this, you do a little of that. Anyway, Don's calling from Lexington. Is that Lexington, Mississippi, Don?
Yes, it is. Lexington, Mississippi.
Ah, right. You know, I'm never sure of my state abbreviations, I have to tell you. At any rate, Don, do you have something you want to ask or talk about or anything?
Yeah, actually, I live in a very small rural part of Mississippi, and I love kimchi and I love pho soup. And because I'm so far from any big city, I have to pretty much make it myself.
Right.
The kimchi that I make is just made of Napa cabbage and daikon radish and spices and stuff like that. But I've heard of people using, like, oysters and other kind of protein-based ingredients, and I was kind of curious how that works.
Well, essentially, I've never heard of the oysters. Let's put it this way. You could probably, with the amount of fermentation and the amount of chili and salt, an oyster would probably be okay. But personally, I'd want to – there are actually sites of really expert – Korean cooks talking about the making of kimchi and all the different versions of it. But kimchi is usually done with cabbage, but you can do it with turnip. You can do it with rutabaga. You can do it with all kinds of things. It's that same formulation and the same very similar fermentation process, but it is a case of the main ingredient changes. And are you really into doing this kind of thing, into fermentation?
Basically with just kimchi. In fact, it's kind of funny. I bring it into the office, and there's a few other people in the office who love it, and there are a few other people who don't. So they since put up a sign that says no kimchi in the office.
I would consider that discrimination, but that's me.
No, pretty much just kimchi making.
Okay, because there's a book on fermentation that's sort of the Bible, and if you wanted to take it further. But you can use other things. The proteins, when you get into animal proteins, that's when I get a little bit nervous because you can get spoilage that's kind of tricky.
That was my concern, and that's kind of why I was just asking the question.
I think, again, that's where I would want to have a really reliable source. Telling me about it because it's a different process. Okay? But, boy, I wish we lived near each other because I'd say bring kimchi. I'd put a big sign on the front door.
I would very much like to bring you something.
That would be lovely, Don. But at any rate, check out sites because you're going to find fascinating stuff. You're going to get so hooked on trying it different ways. It's just going to go on and on.
Okay. All right.
And thanks for a great question.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. You take care. You can send us an email, go to splendidtable.org. You can go to Facebook and Twitter, and you can find us there. And you can call us, 800-537-5252. If you stand in the cooking oil aisle with eyes glazed over in confusion, we all understand. We've been there. And with every new health report, with every new must-try recipe, there is another oil conundrum. Should it be olive, corn, or avocado, sunflower, coconut, or canola? Well, I think Ellie Krieger is a good person to talk to about this. Ellie knows both nutrition and good eating. Her latest book is Weeknight Wonders. And we asked our contributor, Patty Hinnage, to get together with Ellie.
Lovely to be talking with you, Ellie. Great to be here, Patty.
Now, Ellie, if I were in your kitchen right now, which oils would I find?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have a few at my fingertips. Mm-hmm. I have two olive oils in my home, for example. One olive oil is a really full-flavored, cold-pressed, extra virgin olive oil that really does not take heat very well. So I don't use that for cooking. I just use that for salads and for finishing dishes. And the thing that's really neat about it is that this type of olive oil has the most antioxidants. So besides having that great fat profile where you have all those wonderful monounsaturated fats that most of us need more of, you also get antioxidant power. And interestingly, there's research that shows that antioxidant power can help you absorb other nutrients. Mm-hmm. And also, the aroma itself can help add to your satisfaction. One study that I read really seems to support that this ultimately has an effect of leading you to feel more satisfied while potentially eating fewer calories. It's truly aromatherapy in helping you get sort of the most sensuousness out of your food without overeating. But I don't want everything to taste like olive oil. I mean, that to me has a certain type of very distinct profile in terms of flavor. Mm-hmm. So when I want something very neutral, usually when I'm making sort of Asian food that I might want the other spices, the ginger, the garlic, the heat to come through and not compete with anything, then I use canola oil for that. And what I like about canola oil, mm-hmm. it's neutral in flavor and aroma. Mm-hmm. It takes the heat very well. So it has a high smoke point. And also because it's primarily this monounsaturated fat, the same type of fat chain that is in olive oil, not only does that monounsaturated fat have good health benefits, mm-hmm. but it also doesn't break down readily with heat. So besides smoke point with oil, when you're cooking with an oil, you want to look at how does that oil stand up to heat in terms of forming free radicals or becoming rancid?
Right. Exactly. And how do you know when an oil has gone bad? Are there any signs, you know, on the way the oil looks or smells?
You know, I always say the nose knows.
Right.
You won't necessarily be able to tell by looking at it, but you will be able to smell it. So I always recommend taking a whiff of any oil, especially if you haven't used it for a while. And certain oils are more likely to get rancid more quickly mm-hmm. and react more to heat and light than others. And so the oils that react most to heat and light mm-hmm. are your polyunsaturated oils. Mm-hmm. So I was talking a minute ago about olive oil and canola oil, those are monounsaturated. And our body needs polyunsaturated and monounsaturated. So omega-3, for example, is polyunsaturated. However, omega-3 and other polyunsaturated oils, they become rancid very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I love to keep walnut oil, for example. But ideally, you want to keep that in the refrigerator because it's so sensitive to light and heat that will become rancid very quickly. So I buy small quantities of it, and I keep it in the refrigerator. Flaxseed is another example mm-hmm. of a high polyunsaturated omega-3 oil that you'd want to keep in the refrigerator, and you don't want to apply heat to that at all because it will essentially degrade and actually form potentially unhealthy compounds when it is exposed to heat.
Right. You know, I think that in the U.S. we get into these fads with oils. You know, everybody's getting peanut oil, then everybody's getting avocado oil. Then I hear a lot about coconut oil. People are saying how good it is and how tasty it is. Have you used coconut oil for cooking?
Yes, I actually have a jar of extra virgin coconut oil in my fridge. And the thing about coconut oil, I was online researching this, and it's kind of astounding how much misinformation is out there, how much hyperbole. I mean, if you really look online, you're going to see this cures just about every ailment you have. There should be really no sick people walking around because we have this wonderful cure-all. So that's really clearly ridiculous. But that said, I think the virgin coconut oil, the one that's the least processed, is really nice. I'll use it instead of butter, for example, in my rice. And it just infuses it with this tropical flavor. But it's an essence, a tropical essence, more than a strong flavor. The thing about coconut oil is that it's solid at room temperature. And the thing that makes it solid at room temperature is that it's made primarily of saturated fat. Now, the health experts have long said saturated fat's bad for your heart, and that's why sort of coconut oil was on the do not eat list. Mm-hmm. But we are learning more about the type of saturated fat that's in coconut oil. And possibly, and I say this possibly because I really feel like the verdict is not in yet, but it seems that the type of saturated fat that's in coconut oil is not as detrimental to our heart health as we once thought. The way I use it, because I like to be a little more sure before I go out and eat, you know, tablespoons of the stuff, mm-hmm. I like to use it sparingly, and I do recommend using it sparingly because it still does appear to raise cholesterol, and it's better to use other oils which may potentially reduce your cholesterol.
Right. So while the jury's out, use coconut oil sparingly.
Yes.
Ellie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ellie Krieger is author of Weeknight Wonders. Patty Hinnich's latest book is Patty's Mexican Table. Now, Ellie left us with a recipe for tuna and white bean salad with radicchio. It's at splendidtable.org. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from the one and only Julia Child. This is to her husband, Paul. You are the butter to my bread and the breath of my life. Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now take a look at our website, splendidtable.org, to get information on anything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. It's all there at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.